now ready to hear argument in 040961, Gullo Motors versus Chop.
Craig Egan, representative for the petitioner. Petitioner deserves 8 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, good morning, Ms. Bays. I introduce my co-counsel, Alex Valdez, who's with me, counsel for today. It is my honor to be representing Tony Gullo Motors in this matter. The plaintiff in the underlying case was Murray Chopper, a purchaser of an automobile at Gullo Motors. Murray Chopper claims she contracted to buy a particular type of SUV, and Gullo Motors delivered to her another. That's her entire case.
What's the difference in the two?
Pardon?
What's the difference in the two? Leather seats or?
As best I can tell, maybe there was a problem about lumbar seats.
Lumbar supports.
Lumbar supports in the seats. There was some dispute whether those could be added to the regular Highlander, but ultimately the dealership said yes, you could add them to the Highlander.
What about the Michelin tires? Was that a difference?
Certainly not a standard, but certainly seemed to be no problem adding Michelin tires to this automobile.
Were they?
As best I know, they were offered always, but at some point the attorney showed up and said that we're not negotiating anything further on behalf of Ms. Chopper. And from that case, Ms. Chopper recovered from the Court of Appeals both her contract damages and tort damages, including both attorney's fees and punitive damages. Now, while we disagree with the jury's finding that we breached any contract with Ms. Chopper, we're not here challenging that finding. But we certainly do challenge the Court of Appeals' conclusion that plaintiff is entitled, in addition to her contract damages, for tort damages. Since Delaney, this court has been very clear and has consistently held that we will not turn a duty breach that arises under contract into a cause of action for tort, allowing recovery of tort damages. In Crawford, this court concluded that the same reasoning covers deceptive trade practices actions under breach of contract.
But we do recognize fraudulent inducement.
Certainly you identified fraudulent inducement. The problem is this case is backwards. The Court of Appeals said this was fraudulent inducement. The problem was that all of her evidence about whatever it is the fraud that occurred was all after she had accepted the vehicle.
But you can have evidence after to show intent before.
And the jury said there was fraud.
The jury said there was fraud, but again, you have to look at the evidence in this case. Here is the evidence, the facts, and I'll go right to that. Ms. Chapa says, I decided I wanted an SUV. I wanted a four-cylinder SUV because of the mileage. And I went to Gullo Motors because it was the closest dealership to my home. From then on, literally, Ms. Chapa's oral testimony diverges from any other evidence in the case.
Well, now, Rep, are we not arguing no evidence? Or are we arguing, and you do agree that there's a fraudulent inducement claim recognizable that would support many of these damage elements?
No, I don't. I do not agree in the facts of this case that there's a fraudulent inducement claim. There is no evidence of fraudulent inducement. In fact, in this case, there is no evidence, even from Ms. Chapa, that Tony Gullo Motors ever agreed to provide her a Highlander Limited. The evidence in this case, from top side and bottom, is Ms. Chapa said, I want a Highlander Limited. And all of the evidence she presents is that Tony Gullo Motors never would allow her to have a Highlander Limited. They offered her a Highlander with upgrades. They didn't give her the upgrades that they offered her. They presented her with the only written documents here at all on any contract that shows no Highlander Limited, but just a Highlander. Her point on that is, I saw their contract. I didn't agree with their contract. I changed their contract, but they didn't sign it. I wrote in Limited on a contract when I noticed it wasn't there. They took the contract from me saying they needed more signatures. I never saw the contract come back. This is not a situation where they said, we'll sell you a Highlander Limited, and then they did not. This is a case where Ms. Chapa said, I want a Highlander Limited, and they wouldn't sell it to me. But even if that were the case, even if this were fraud and inducement, you have to change your position based on fraud and inducement. Changing the position means that I suffered some harm. The issue in this case is, what was the contract? And the jury said, the Highlander Limited. And as a result, your reward is the difference in the value of the Highlander Limited that you say you contracted for, and the Highlander that was delivered. That was her damages. That's what she claimed to be her damages. In her testimony, she said, that's what this was all about. I didn't get the car I contracted for. Fraudulent inducement claims are that I get into a contract I did not want. That's fraudulent inducement. The facts in this case, the jury gave her exactly what she said she contracted for, the Highlander Limited, or rather, the economic value, the difference between what she said she contracted for and what she received.
Well, viewing the facts in perhaps the best light for Ms. Chapa, she says, I asked for a Highlander Limited. The salesman promised me a Highlander Limited. I showed up, and they said it was here. The vehicle was here, ready to be picked up. It was not a Limited, so I left. They said they'd get me the Limited. Came back again. They said it was a Limited. It wasn't a Limited. They were supposed to put the additional options on. So they gave me something they promised. They gave me something that they different from what they promised they were going to give me, and then forged documents and concealed documents to cover up that. Is that sufficient for a jury to find fraudulent inducement? Is there a scintilla, more than a scintilla of evidence in there to support the intent to make a promise that you're not gonna carry out before the transaction was consummated?
No, Your Honor, because this court has held if the duty that is breached arises under contract, it's a contract damage claim, contract breach claim, not a tort claim. In your scenario,
why couldn't the duty arise from the alleged misrepresentation? You promised me a Limited, but then you don't give me a Limited, and didn't intend to give me a Limited, is what she's arguing.
Your Honor, under the Crawford case, that issue was addressed. Can you, by the representation under the contract obligation, create a tort by then declaring you breached that representation? The guts of this case is not that, like in Formosa, you agree to let me have the opportunity to control the delivery schedule over here, and as a result, I'll give you a different bid price than I'd otherwise give you. This is exactly the case where I went in to buy a Highland Limited from a person who sells Highland Limiteds. They promised to sell me a Highland Limited and did not do so. Therefore, it's a fraud because it's a breach of the representation, and I'm entitled to emotional damages and punitive damages.
But in fact,
the duty arises under the contract.
How about less than fraud? Could it be a deceptive trade practice? Assume it's not fraud.
Your Honor, in Crawford, this court addressed that question. If the duty arises under the contract, if the object of the contract was the delivery of that Highlander Limited, then it's not a deceptive trade practice. This court has been very clear. If the duty arises under the contract, and your claim is that duty is breached, then it's a breach of contract. It's not tort damages.
What if a dealer was taking the little silver thing on the back that says Limited in cursive and sticking it, pasting it onto cars that weren't Limited? That might be a deceptive trade practice, wouldn't it? Representing that the car is something that it's not, maybe not fraud, if you've already agreed on the price and paid, but there might be circumstances where something less than fraud would be a DTPA.
I think the answer to that one is, if I didn't contract with them for them to sell me a Limited and they failed to do so, then I might have a claim under DTPA, which is, in fact, to create a cause of action where there is no other cause of action. So I go to the Highlander, I go to the Gull Motors, and I just see cars on the lot, and I say, boy, I really like that because the Limited sticker's there. And I go buy it, and I go out, and I'm not claiming under the contract they agreed to sell it to me. I'm saying I bought something based on what they were representing here, and therefore my cause of action is amended. Even though I don't have a contract claim against them, my duty arises elsewhere, where there's a representation of liability.
I'll ask you just briefly on the attorney's fees question. Claiming they should have segregated, of course, they cite Stewart Title, which says a recognized exception to this duty to segregate arises when they're intertwined inextricably. This was in 1991 when the court said that. I wasn't here. I have trouble finding where this recognized exception appeared before 1991. Did the court ever say inextricably intertwined before 91 that you're aware of?
I'm not aware that they said inextricably intertwined.
It's a mouthful.
I think it's just recognized the practical realities. If the same evidence proves two things, how do you say, well, half of it was this cause and the other one? But I don't think we even have to go there. In this case, if there's a recovery under tort, they have to demonstrate that they had an independent duty that was breached and caused damages. In this case, the only duty that they show that we claim was there was breach of contract. They claim they escaped that because they have a separate duty, separate obligations, separate representations, and separate damages. So they themselves set up this case to say they're not inextricably intertwined. They're separate issues. Our difference with them is, and always has been, their entire case is, I went to Gullah Motors, I asked for a Highlander Limited, they gave me a Highlander.
And I'm therefore damaged. Can you envision a scenario, though, where they say, okay, we're going to do a bait and switch here. Let's do the old Highlander Limited routine. We're going to go tell them we're going to sell them a Highlander Limited, and we're going to, you know, say it's on order. I mean, what if this something like this could be premeditated, that we're just going to pull this scheme and we will forge documents if we need to? I mean, based on your argument, you could never pursue that as a fraud claim.
May I ask the question?
Yes, sir.
I thought about that very question. In fact, they suggest bait and switch. That's why I go back to how this began. This is not a situation where Ms. Chapa received word from Gullah Motors, we'll sell you a Highlander Limited. In fact, all the evidence is that Gullah Motors was not going to sell her a Highlander Limited, particularly because she wasn't going to pay the price. But I'm not going to argue about the breach of contract issue. What I'm going to say, bait and switch says, I'm going to sell you this.
Has to be
paid. And then when I buy it, then I find out it's something different than what you said.
A bait and switch is different from just a switch.
A bait and switch is different than a switch.
Gotta
and
be
in
bait.
Fact, all of the don't be too confused by the forgeries that are out here. There are some that she acknowledges has her signature on, which are the we owe you slips of paper, which is what she and Garcia negotiated over on the add-ons, which is the ultimate outcome of this case.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Kristen Bays will present argument for the respondent.
I would say it's an honor to appear before you today. I'm very pleased to be here. I think the problem that this court has identified through some of its questions is the core problem with the position that you hear about from Gullah Toyota related to the economic loss rule. Essentially, to conclude, as does Gullah, that Ms. Chapa has no tort or DTPA claims, this court would have to overrule literally centuries of case law, beginning with Graham v. Roeder in 1849, recognizing that litigants can recover in both contract and tort when duties in both are breached. And again, Gullah's position would require this court to eliminate from Texas's jurisprudence DTPA and fraud causes of action because, as you pointed out, Justice O'Neill, you could never recover if the fraud was so successful that it ended in a contract. There is just no justification from this court departing from what is...
What was the fraud? What was the evidence of fraud?
The evidence of fraud, legally... The claim of fraud was they promised her a Toyota Highlander Limited, never intending to deliver it.
Well, that's true of every contract.
Well, that is not necessarily true of every contract. I may well contract with you fully intending to perform.
Every breach of contract case where the parties dispute what the contract was, a jury could find in favor of the plaintiff or the defendant, but in favor of the plaintiff, that you promised what the plaintiff says and you delivered only what the defendant says. So that would turn every case where we didn't have the written contract, where the parties dispute what the terms are, into a fraud, wouldn't it?
It would, which this court addressed in both the Speljarek opinion back in 1986 and the Formosa opinion back in 1998 to ensure that that doesn't happen. What the evidence has to be is something more than non-performance. The evidence has to be circumstantial evidence, and it may be evidence that occurs after the breach, Justice O'Neill, but it proves intent before, that shows that there was never any intention to perform.
Now, specify exactly what that evidence is.
In this case, Ms. Chapa's testimony, obviously, was some evidence of these facts. But the documentary evidence was probably more compelling, since generally documents are more compelling than testimony. What the documents in this case revealed was that Gullo defended the entire case based on its Exhibit 25. That was ostensibly the contract between it and Ms. Chapa, and it reflected that Ms. Chapa purchased the exact vehicle that was delivered to her. No question that if that's the contract, it wasn't breached. But the problem with that contract was that it identified the vehicle by a vehicle identification number, which Gullo's own documents admitted as evidence reflected could not have been there on the date the contract was signed. The contract was signed on December 29th. Gullo did not acquire that vehicle on a dealer trade until 6 days later on January 4th. That number couldn't have appeared on the contract. What's more, the contract makes no mention of any options that Ms. Chapa would have purchased. And yet, when Gullo made its second delivery of a base model vehicle, that car had been taken to a third-party vendor at the expense of Gullo to put in leather seats, which our evidence demonstrated came standard in a Limited, and to put in a TV VCR, which was an option that Ms. Chapa testified she did purchase with the purchase of the Limited. But there is no reflection that any such purchase was made in the contract that Gullo said was the agreement.
But again, let's say you and I get in a dispute about what we agreed to, and so after that dispute arises, I forge a document which just happens to fit my version of the facts. Does that prove that proves only that we're in a fight, breach of contract now? That doesn't prove back at the time we made this agreement I was intending to defraud you, does it?
It doesn't necessarily, but I guess I would remind the court of what the treatises say about a brick not being a wall. That one piece of evidence by itself may not carry the day, but when that evidence is added to testimony about what the agreement was, when it is added to testimony that when you signed an actual contract that reflected the terms that the plaintiff said were the agreement, that document was taken from you never to be seen again.
But again, in every breach of contract, we disagree about the terms. You say we signed a contract that had your terms in it, and since we don't have it now, I must have destroyed it. Don't we just turn every contract case where we're disputing the terms becomes a fraud?
Unless the dispute about the terms was, as it was in this case, about what the promise was. This wasn't, for example, a dispute about when the car was to be delivered or what the purchase price for the car would be. This was a dispute about what she bought, the subject matter of the contract. Not just terms that would be important aspects of the contract, but the core subject matter of what it was that she was purchasing. That was what was in dispute. And this court acknowledged in the Speljarek opinion, and again in Formosa, that when there is when the defendant denies that it ever made a promise that the jury concludes was in fact made, that is some evidence, circumstantial, that there was never an intention to perform when that promise was made. That was the evidence in our case.
So we just don't need breach of contract anymore. We can do it all by fraud.
Well, not necessarily.
I mean, name me one circumstance where we disagree about the terms of our contract that I will only be able to sue in contract rather than fraud.
It would be any case that would involve a dispute about the terms of the contract based on a claim of ambiguity, and that frequently occurs in breach of contract cases. If the dispute between the two of us is whether that vehicle identification number was the correct one or whether some of the numbers were transposed so that I had actually purchased a Maserati, that would be a breach of contract dispute between the two of us. But if my claim was, I always purchased a Maserati, look at the purchase price in the contract. Why would I have ever spent $150,000 on a Toyota Highlander Limited? Now we have delved into the realm of whether you made me a promise, never intending to deliver it. And it is well said in Texas law, that's fraud in the inducement. That sounds in tort. And those were the facts that the jury was convinced of in this case, unanimously. And those are the facts made final by the Court of Appeals' agreement with them. This court must accept as true that Gullo promised a Limited, never intending to deliver that car. So for the court to conclude that Ms. Chapa has no tort claims, this court would then have to conclude that's not a tort. It is. And Ms. Chapa is entitled to recover under it for any tort damages associated with it. Those would be her benefit of the bargain damages, her mental anguish damages, the treble damages, or rather the penalty damages against Mr. Garcia under the DTPA, also attorney's fees. Now, Gullo complains about these. What Gullo says, rightly, is that Ms. Chapa never segregated her attorney's fees between her breach of contract and DTPA claims on the one hand and her fraud claims on the other. But there are two reasons why this does not prevent Ms. Chapa from recovering her attorney's fees in this case. The first is the Stewart title opinion. This court made it clear that when the facts overlap, as they certainly do in this case, among causes of action for which attorney's fees are recoverable on some and not on others, when the facts overlap and presentation of the case requires attention to those facts, you don't need to segregate.
Because why not? 100 years of Texas law says you can only get attorney's fees for statutory reasons or contract. Now, when you're drafting the petition in this case, were you the trial counsel?
Yes.
Okay. When you're drafting the petition in this case, you get to the paragraph on fraud. Now, that's not a statutory cause of action. It's not a contract. And for the whatever limited amount of time you're writing the fraud provision, if you recover attorney's fees, 100% of your attorney's fees, then you just recovered at least some small amount of attorney's fees for something that 100 years of Texas law says you can't get attorney's fees for. Why isn't Sterling? Now, Sterling's a different case. Sterling is where he says, you breached the contract. No, you breached the contract. And to win, it's true. You have to prove that they breached first. Ours is a little different. Ours is a tack-on for something that you can't get attorney's fees for, and if your jury awards 100% of the attorney's fees, we've just breached 100 years of Texas law, haven't we?
Well, potentially. But in the hypothetical that you've outlined, I don't think so. And again, this is why the overlap becomes an important consideration on whether segregation is even possible. Because in your hypothetical about drafting the petition, it is true that there would be some time spent drafting allegations related to a cause of action for which attorney's fees might not be awarded. But in Texas, under Rule 26, we plead facts. So the essence of pleading a petition is to write up the set of facts that pertains to a particular case and then identify what damages are associated with the claims being raised. The point is that there's just too much overlap, even though these are tack-on causes of action. It's not a true direct attack. You breached, you didn't breach. This is a case where the facts are so intertwined, inexplicably so, or inexplicably, that would be the wrong word. I'm not going to try to say it again.
It's got to be an easier term.
I'm going to leave it at that. Too Freudian, but the facts are so intertwined, it really becomes difficult, if not impossible.
What would be wrong with a rule to say you have to segregate in every case, and then you just get on the stand and say 99.5% of what I did was related to DTPA or contract alone? What would be wrong with that rule?
Really nothing. That would be an appropriate rule and one that this court could adopt, and frankly a sensible one, because it ensures that the attorney's fees do apply to the causes of action for which they're recoverable. But that actually raises an interesting issue for this court to consider, is whether Ms. Chapa actually pled any causes of action for which attorney's fees would not be recoverable. Fraud, typically, as you have pointed out, does not carry with it an award of attorney's fees. Obviously, breach of contract and DTPA do. That's statutorily based. But this court in the early 90s suggested that perhaps attorney's fees would be an appropriate recovery on a fraud claim, given how closely intertwined fraud and breach of contract claims are. For instance, in Eagle Properties versus Scharbauer and Williams v. Kaloff, companion cases decided in 1990, this court applied the 4-year statute of limitations applicable to contract cases to fraud cases because of the similarities. Later on, in 1991, I'm sorry, that's not right, in 1990, this court in the Gill Savings case versus Cherking reviewed a case where attorney's fees were awarded for fraud based on a breach of contract, very similar to the facts of this case. The question before the court was whether it was really appropriate for the trial court to have not given an award of attorney's fees for appellate fees and bankruptcy fees, and this court remanded to the trial court for consideration of what those fees would be, finding that they should have been awarded, again, on a fraud claim. This court didn't say it explicitly, and in fact, in Schindler versus Ostwell Farms, this court noted that that would be a decision saved for another day. Perhaps today is that day. There is such an overlap between fraud claims, and as you pointed out, it's virtually impossible to imagine a fraud claim that would not involve a contract in some form or fashion. Because of this overlap, it may well be, and perhaps should be, permissible for litigants suing for fraud to also be able to recoup their attorney's fees under the same theory of using the Civil Practice and Remedies Code Section 38001 sub 8, which permits and is to be liberally construed an award of attorney's fees associated with contractual claims. So Ms. Chapa ought to recover her attorney's fees. Of course, the big issue in this case pertains to her exemplary damages, particularly those against Gullah. The ones related to Mr. Garcia have been conceded.
The exemplary damages awarded would exceed the DPA.
They certainly would.
So don't you have to elect? You can't recover on fraud and contract and DPA.
That is exactly
and
right.
And isn't that what the Buck Beaumont Court did? Didn't they just give you back everything under all claims and so you didn't have to pick?
Well, I guess my answer would be sort of. But please bear in mind that we did make an election at the time that we went to get a judgment entered. We did make that election because you're absolutely right. We cannot recover on all causes of action in a judgment that would violate the one satisfaction rule. Our election was to recover under the DTPA against Mr. Garcia and to recover under the fraud claims with Gullah Toyota. So Gullah's liability and Mr. Garcia's liability would be joint and several as to the actual damages and the attorney's fees, if this court concludes that they are recoverable for fraud, but they would be separate as to the penalty damages under the DTPA against Mr. Garcia and the exemplary damages under the Civil Practice and Remedies Code for fraud against Gullah.
But if we decided there was no evidence of fraud, then you would fall back on DTPA, I assume, next.
Since that is
a larger recovery than contract.
That is exactly right. And under Rule 301, we are entitled to the largest recovery that we could get based upon the verdict, the pleadings, the evidence. So we certainly would. But I think the evidence of fraud is sufficient. I frankly think this is a case that cries out for the imposition of exemplary damages under Chapter 41.
Well, I mean, that's a little strong. If I understand the facts here, if I go to my car dealer and get the wrong trim line, I get an extra $200,000. And we'll probably have people lining up to do that, won't we?
Well, you certainly would if that were the case.
Not only do I get a car, not quite the car I wanted, but I get an extra $200,000 where I can buy four or five more.
Frankly, I suspect you would hope that there would be retailers out there that would treat you in that fashion.
But, I mean, the purpose of exemplary damages is not to encourage people to file suits. It's to encourage people not to do this kind of behavior. This is probably a little bit much, isn't it?
I think it is not. I would respectfully disagree with you. And the reason is because this is a case that involved not just your plain old vanilla acts of fraud, not just misrepresentations about trim packages or the color of the vehicle that you'll receive, not even just, as you pointed out before, taking the Limited sign off of a True Limited and pasting it onto a base model Highlander. This is a case where Ms. Chapa came in with $30,207 cash and said, I want the Limited on the showroom floor. Fellow said, that one's been sold. We can get you one just like it. And they never intended to do that. The evidence, in fact, revealed that they never intended to do that, so much so that when she finally called them on the carpet about it, they produced forged documents, including two that bore the signature of her husband, which was suspicious given that he was deceased at the time that these documents were to have been signed. Those are felonies under the penal code. Each one of those acts of forgery, each one of those incidents of securing the execution of the document by deception, destroying the real contract between the parties, each one of those carries with it under the penal code $10,000 penalty and incarceration. This is the outrageous misconduct that the court focused on in the Owens Corning case and the Morial opinion. This is the case that justifies an imposition of punitive damages to punish and deter. But as you pointed out,
the question I have is, if you come in and say, I want to buy this car, and the dealer says, well, I'll sell it to you, and he doesn't have any intention of doing it, and so the buyer comes back at the appointed time and says, well, here I am, here's the money, and the dealer says, well, I lied, I really just to take advantage of you, because, you know, you look like somebody I could lie to. A very bad facts. Where's the injury there? I mean, you have your money, you don't have the car, but there's no reliance damages, nothing as bad has happened. If it were the only one in the world, then maybe you would. But if you can just walk down the street and do the same thing, then it's hard to see where the damage is. Now, I know that's not this case, but what's your response to that?
Well, it would depend, again, on some additional facts that may be included in your hypothetical. As you've outlined it, there really is no damage. But if you went back to the dealership and they said, well, you know, I've lied. I never intended to sell you that car. And by the way, if you mention that to anyone at all, you will discover who you are dealing with, as did Gullo here, causing you mental anguish and concern about whether you were perhaps dealing with an entity that was so unscrupulous and criminal that you may actually be in danger if you complain. I think perhaps you have suffered damages, even though you have retained the benefit of the bargain money that you would have paid them for the car. Those are the facts of this case, established by the Court of Appeals and found by the jury. This is a situation where this is outrageous conduct, deserving attention and exemplary damages. The trouble with exemplary damages in Texas, really, is that because they're designed to be a penalty imposed by juries, there is always a concern, a legitimate one, that juries may just have knee-jerk reactions, emotional responses, and come up with numbers with so many zeros behind
them.
To
car salesmen, that's hard to believe. Juries would want to punish car salesmen.
It perhaps isn't. But with that being said, this is a case where the facts of the case, not to mention the defendant, could, in fact, create an emotional reaction from a jury that would not be based on the law or the evidence and would therefore be violative of the due process clause. That is a fair concern. I think it's one that doesn't exist in this case. But it is a fair concern that deserves judicial attention, which gives this court the opportunity with this case to instruct courts of appeals in Texas about an issue that has plagued them. How do we know if an award is grossly excessive? How do we know if it has a reasonable relationship? There are three ways, and three only. It is a three-step analysis. And the law has established it that this court ought to write it up very clearly so that this confusion no longer exists in the state. The first is you give deference to the jury. The statute speaks to that directly under section 41010 sub B, but the U.S. Supreme Court has spoken to that even more clearly four times in the last 4 years. In the Haslip opinion, the court noted, these matters have always been left to the jury for more than 200 years. It takes a strong case under the Due Process Clause to undo that. And in the TXO opinion, the court noted, as long as there is a fair procedure that is followed, whatever flows from it, whatever award flows from it, is one that should be entitled to a strong presumption of validity, perhaps an irrebuttable one. Our statute provides that fair procedure. If it is complied with, if the evidence supports the award, it passes constitutional muster.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Just a couple of comments about it. I appreciate the court's concern about the conduct in this case and what exactly do you do. I stand by my position that I see no way that you can hold that there's a fraud claim here that's viable without creating a fraud claim in every breach of contract case. But even if the court disagrees with me on that, I do believe the decision Jim Walter Holmes by this court is instructive. It looks at the object of the contract and it looks at the object of the damages. What is the key here? The object of the contract was she wanted a Highlander Limited. She got a Highlander, and her damages was the difference in value of those cars. What was the object of her damages? The difference in the value of those cars.
She gets the difference in the value of those cars from the jury. In addition, she gets emotional damages and punitive damages. And Jim Walter Holmes, it says, you are going to look and see what the complaint is. The complaint is you bought a home. You said the home didn't meet what you contracted to buy. Therefore, you're limited to your contract damages. That's how this case gets decided. Her claim was, I didn't get the car that I contracted to buy, and the jury awarded the value of the difference. That is the object of the contract. That's the object of the damages. I'd like to refer to the hypothetical that Ms. Bays raised with you, the Maserati. This is not a case where Ms. Chapa paid $36,000 for a Highlander Limited and got a Highlander. It's just the opposite. This is a case where she offered $24,000 for a Highlander Limited, and she was told, no, that's a $36,000 automobile. Then over the course of the dispute, she ends up paying $30,000, which includes a Highlander and add-ons. Now, she's going to argue, no, they said they'd sell me a Highlander Limited for $30,000. This is not a situation where she paid the purchase price for a Highlander Limited. This is a place where she paid less than and knew when she first went in that they wouldn't sell it for the first price she offered. So the hypotheticals don't quite hold up. On the fraud case, I think the court in dealing with this has to think of this. There must be more to prove an intent to defraud than merely, I'm going to contest the contract terms. Spoljarek is out there. I understand the language that's there. But there has to be more to prove fraud in the contract context, that is, when the duty arises under contract, prove that there was no intent to comply with the contract, then simply evidence that one of the contracting parties denies the contract exists.
Are you saying we have to overrule Spoljarek to rule in your favor?
You don't have to in this case, but I don't think Spoljarek forecloses this court in addressing the question about fraud and breach of contract cases, that there has to be more than simply, I'm not going to comply with the contract. Let's talk about the forgeries in this case. The forgeries in this case. Forgeries, fraud, deceptive practices. Ms. Chapa has to change her position based on the forgeries, the fraud, the deceptive practices. She has to do something because she's led into those.
Well,
issues.
But they're using that to show the intent all along. That's my understanding of the import of that evidence.
The intent not to sell her what they contracted to sell her, but she won on that. She won on the contract. I mean, the only thing it goes to is to say, we don't have this contract. And so I suppose potentially the court could say, you created false documents to try and win the trial of this case. We ought to sanction you for a fraud on the court. We ought to sanction you for bringing false documents before the court. That's kind of the issue if we're talking about what the proof of the contract is. But she didn't buy a Highlander from them based on them forging those documents. This all happened after the fact. She walks in and says, that's not my contract. Where is my contract? Well, this is the only document we have. No, I wrote on a document. I changed the terms of a document. I put my handwriting on a document, and I don't see it on these documents. That's the evidence in this case, all after the fact, all after she's driving a Highlander with agreed-upon add-ons that she now argues they didn't add to and didn't put on her car. We're talking about a contract breach.
If the rule was you had to segregate attorney's fees in all cases, and Ms. Bays or whoever the attorney fees expert was had said, well, 99.5% of my time was spent, would have had to been spent if I had just brought contract and DTPA. Would you have had any grounds to appeal at that point? It's just because it's 100% and something had to be related to fraud that brings you here on the segregation point, is it not?
I think that's right, Your Honor.
So if the rule was you have to segregate in all cases, but you can say whatever percentage, then I guess the courts of appeals would decide on a factual sufficiency basis, and this court maybe if it's possible to make a legal sufficiency argument. And we wouldn't have this all or nothing situation where we decide was segregation required, you get nothing, or do another trial.
That's correct, Your Honor. There are some courts of appeals that thought that that was a remand question because they would meet the no evidence standard on a segregation, but not the adequate evidence, sufficiency evidence standard, and they would remand it. On the other hand, there is an obligation to segregate your fees when the objection is made and go forward with the proof, and having failed to do so,
but
then there's no evidence that it's segregated.
As a trial judge, I know it drove juries crazy. Let's say we just had DTPA in contract. If the appeals court reverses DTPA and just awards contract, appeals court's faced with a decision. Do we cut the attorney's fees? Or do we send it back to the trial court where the new jury is going to be mad at everybody about describing attorney's fees for a case we did 4 years ago? And is there any way around this cumbersome process of when something's eliminated on appeal, having to do a second trial on attorney's fees?
Well, of course, I'd argue under the Green International case, you all said, if there's an objection, they don't segregate, that's the end of the inquiry.
Yeah.
So I hope that's the decision of the court, but it may not be. I understand there's other cases out there. I did have a couple of comments. We didn't really talk about the remittiture issue and on the punitive damages issue, and I'm available to answer any questions about that. I do have, I believe, a point. They agreed to the remittiture and therefore had a judgment in their case in lieu of a remand. I do not believe that they can raise the punitive damages issue before this court. Remittiture obviously is a factual inquiry. This court doesn't have jurisdiction of it, but they did agree to the remittiture and as a result obtained a judgment out of the Court of Appeals. So I don't believe that issue can properly be raised here. On the statute, the punitive damages issue, I didn't hear any argument on that. I think that's been adequately addressed in the brief.
Are there any further questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Enoch. That concludes the argument and all arguments for today. And Marshall will now adjourn the court.
All right. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.